Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Hello, my name's Nigel Jones, and I'm Sales and Marketing Director at Practice Plan, and welcome to today's podcast. The topic for this podcast is how to build up a successful private dental practice. And I'm very pleased to be joined by Simon Thackeray, who's the owner of a private dental practice. And we're going to be spending a bit of time exploring how he went about developing that. But Simon, if I could ask you to begin with, if you could just introduce yourself and give us an insight into your background.
Oh, thank you, Nigel. I qualified in 1991 and I was 100% NHS. It was the only way, north of England kind of thing. And as was the thing at the time, aspired to buy a practice. So after about 5 or 6 years moving around other NHS practices, finally found a suitable candidate, which was a rundown NHS practice in Mansfield, and bought it and tried to put my stamp on it fairly swiftly whilst staying within the NHS. So we invested quite a lot of money at a time that probably people didn't invest in the same way. We put digital x-rays in, we computerized, we refurbished it completely, and everything was fine and dandy, and it was the best thing I ever bought. And then the new contract came out in 2006, and I thought, oh, I might not have a business.
So what was it about the new contract that unnerved you then?
I just didn't like the way it was worded, and the way it was very vague, and everything that you can provide. And I'd always prided myself that I wanted to do my dentistry the way I was trained to do it, and I didn't really want a system to dictate to me how I provided care for my patients. It was always about trying to do the best you can possibly can, because that's what I've always been, that's my ethos, to do the best I can. Having my own practice, I wasn't constrained by bosses sort of saying, we want you to do it this way. Not that any of them did particularly, but it was always that, yeah, but I could do this a bit different, and I could practice. If I had my own place, I'd do that. And when I saw the NHS contract, I basically thought I was going to give my practice away to the NHS. They could terminate my income. They were going to dictate by opening hours and all manner of things. And I thought, you know, if you want my practice, why don't you just buy it off me? And I'll sell it you. So I thought I had to move it out of the grip or the clutches, potentially, of the NHS, and decided, as a lot of people did at the time, I've got to go private. And I did it about a year before the new contract came out, because I could see the sort of the writing on the wall. And it was probably the best business decision I've ever made.
So what sort of steps did you go through to make that decision and then implement the decision?
Well, the steps started with talking to other practitioners about what they thought of the NHS and where they were going. And the general morale wasn't great. And I was frustrated with it, because it didn't give me... I'm not income driven in the way that a lot of people are, but it didn't give me the returns that I felt, not that I deserved, but that the work that I was doing and the quality that I was doing didn't seem to represent the figures that were coming in. And I thought, if I want to aspire to better, then, you know, I'd like that to be a bit better as well. So we talked to other colleagues, and then you start the looking around. Well, how do you go private? What do you do? There's the fear that the second you say you're going to go private, every single patient will go to your competitor. How do you manage that? What do you do there? And at the time, I was a lot younger, more naive, not knowing of things like Practice Plan and other companies that were available to talk to. You tend to spend a lot of it in a darkness that, oh my God, what's going to happen here? Oh, we'll not bother doing it then. And then the resistance of your practice team to it, because they want to know what's going on with their incomes. You know, you've got a big responsibility as a practice owner, not just to yourself, but to these other people who you employ and your patients at the end of the day. So then it was just a case of saying, well, what do I want for the future? How do I want to work? Personally, I didn't want to drive myself into an early grave by worrying about, have I said this right on this contract? And I thought, I bought the practice to be in control of where it goes. That includes who I see, when I see them, and actually when I open and close and shut the practice and sell the practice and things like that. I don't have to tell them when I'm, you know, off and thinking of selling it. So then it was a case of lining up, well, who are the practice providers that can help me with this? And people started pointing me in the direction of practice plan. And then it was just a case of having the confidence one day to pick up the phone and ring to have somebody come around and talk to me about it. And that's literally then where that journey started.
And you mentioned there about having the confidence to pick up the phone.
Yeah.
That doesn't normally take confidence. So what was it that made it feel like a big step?
It was... I don't like particularly phoning anybody up. I've just got a thing about phoning, and I don't talk to my patients on the phone because I always think they're going to complain about me. That's why they want to speak to me. And it's not usually like that. But it's more the fear that I'm putting something in place now that are steps that I may well not be able to reverse. And because I am now moving out of my field of comfort, my field of experience, what if I've made a mistake? Buying a practice actually was easier because I bought a practice that was doing NHS dentistry, and that's all I'd known. So I knew how that system worked. Whereas when you suddenly turn around and it's like private practice, whoa, that's like a different thing.
So that sounds like it's a combination of fear of the unknown.
Oh, yes.
And also you were talking about before about wanting control.
Yeah.
But worried about potentially being put on a conveyor belt that would take you down a route that even if you didn't want to go down anymore. Yeah,
potentially so. You know, you may make a phone call sometimes and you say, I'm thinking of doing this. You're setting a ball in motion. At what point, you know, would I get carried away with that and realise it was a mistake? Or, you know, am I actually correct in picking the phone up and saying that? Because really, it'll probably be all right. I like to try and be optimistic and, yeah, this is only a little blip and the new contract might not be that bad and it might be all right. But the more and more I thought about it, the more and more I agonised about it, and it took a long time, the more and more I realised is, look, I can't do this. You know, professionally, I wouldn't be able to stay in the NHS for what I felt. And actually, personally, I think a lot of people don't realise the effect that we as dentists probably have on our nearest and dearest. And I think my wife, Claire, would probably, if I hadn't have rung them, she would have rung.
I think that's such an interesting book. So what would she
say? Yeah, she just basically, you either do this or you put up and shut up, basically. Yeah. So you ring them and say, get someone out to talk to me, instead of going, well, but what if, you don't know. They do, they've done it. She's the pragmatic one. And I think of all the what ifs and what can go wrong. She's the one who says, yeah, but you don't know because it hasn't happened yet. And I now start to think that way. But she said, you need to speak to someone who's done it. Because you never know, there could be a practice that's exactly the same as yours that's done it and been very successful. And they might actually turn around to you and say, do you know what, your practice can't do it. And I thought, oh, all right, so I've got actually nothing to lose and everything to gain. So that's when we decided to do it.
I think that point about nearest and dearest is so important. It's still one of my favourite memories in the time that I've been working with practices. One of the practices in Kent that I helped go private, I went to see them a year after they'd done that, and the husband was the dentist, the wife was the practice manager, and I saw the wife and I said, how are things going? And her immediate response was, brilliant, he's coming home and talking to the kids now.
Yeah.
And that, I thought, this is a job that's worth doing from my point of view, to be helping people do that, because it's that impact on nearest dearest, I think does get lost. But having had that confidence to pick up the phone and get the ball rolling, did it feel like actually you were back in control again?
Or yes, yeah. Absolutely. Because I think, I can't remember exactly how many meetings I had. It was Michelle who held our hand through it. And it was quite important for me that I had a first line person to speak to who actually got the values and the ethos of what I wanted. And Michelle just got it almost straight away. But there was still that, yeah, but... what if? And I think it came to a point, it was one lunchtime, It was one lunchtime, we'd had the final meeting, Michelle sat there, and I just said, right, let's do it, let's do it. And the decision surprised me. I went up into the surgery just afterwards, and I'm like, oh my God, what have I just done? Okay, yes, I know I've got the pull out, I can do this and that and the other, but actually I've done the right thing. And the fear sort of, it set in a little bit more with regards, oh my God, I really don't know what's going to happen now because I am in uncharted territory for me. But there was also the fact that, you know what, I've just done that, I've decided it, and I'm now going to decide the destiny of this practice, my family and everything else. And actually that's what I bought the practice for. So I was happy as well that I'd done it. But yeah, the fear of jumping into the unknown, because you just think, oh, how's this work? You know, I've got to suddenly not got the safety net of the NHS brand, and the fact that, oh yeah, I only have to talk to patients about, I think the maximum charge then was £240 or something. And you're suddenly going to think, hang on, I can't, my crowns are going to be more than that, and you might need two, and ooh, money, you have to talk about money to patients, and there's a lot of...
And what about your team? Because were they going through similar sort of anxieties? Yeah, about...
Absolutely. There's one of the members of the team had been there the longest, said, if you ever go private, I'll leave. And she's still with me. And she is one of the biggest advocates now of dentistry, private dentistry, because she understands what difference it's made to the patients in how we offer stuff and how we provide it in our practice. And she would now be one of the first people to leave if I said, well, I'm going to go back to the NHS. And in fact, you know, she would probably, well, she'd walk out. So the team get very, very involved with it, because often they're the ones who are in Tesco and a patient comes along and says, your dentist has just sent me this letter saying you're going private. What's that all about? And it impacts on their life where previously it didn't. So you've handed off a load of stress by saying, right, I've done it, we're going private. And suddenly your team are being accosted in the supermarket saying, why is he doing this then? Why is he doing that then? And I think if you've got a team who genuinely believe it as well, because they see the benefits to the patients and they see the benefits to them, everybody's then singing from the same hymn sheet. Everybody in your team should share the same values anyway. You should put your team together that espouse the same ethics and the same morals as you do. And I don't think that's always the case. But the positive environment that you get from working with a team that... Somebody once said that you could take any member of my staff and cut them through. If they were a piece of rock, they would say your name through the middle of it. And I thought, it's an interesting analogy, but yeah. And if your team don't do that, you will probably find that there are some resistances, but you can manage them out.
And how did you get the sort of buy-in then from the team? So you've assembled the right team with the right values and beliefs and ethos, and then you had to communicate the decision to them. So
the buy-in from them, we'd made it a team decision to a degree. I know it was always going to be my decision, but at a very early stage in the discussions, we're involving them with why we would possibly need to do this. And it was all about, should we do this? And asking them and asking them what their fears and concerns are about dentistry and careers. You know, some of them are as career-oriented as we are. Some of them are not. Some of them will actually leave and go and get another job. And you don't necessarily have to worry about them then. But the ones who are with you and the ones who get it, they have their own fears. What's going to happen to me and where are we going to go? What's going to happen to the patients? What about those patients who can't afford it? And you have to come up then with sort of scenarios. And, well, if a patient can't afford it, we're private. We don't have to charge them. We could turn around and do some pro bono work. And as soon as you start saying, it's not my intention to charge everybody absolutely everything every single time, I'm not that hard-faced a businessman that I can't turn around to some of the patients and think, do you know what? You know, that I feel I need to do this for you. And being able to do that in a truly altruistic way, the girls got it straight away because they said, well, why wouldn't we do that then? And then they become the ones who are the advocates, because they then turn around and say, in the same way as your family does, when are we going to do it? You can explain that you can invest more in them, because if you structure your business accordingly, you will not necessarily make any more profit yourself. You can make more profit yourself. That's fine. But if you've got a practice that's now got an income that can be tailored to the individual needs of everybody in it, you can invest in a nurse, you can invest in a practice manager, you can go and do things like Investors in People, where people get a buzz out of being part of a tribe, out of a bigger entity, and they truly feel a part of something rather than just somebody coming to work. And if you get that buy-in in a certain way, and I didn't know as much about that kind of thing then as I did now, I sort of did that accidentally, because I suppose I was thinking, I'm not confident enough necessarily to make this decision entirely on my own, and I'm not arrogant enough to do it either. And I was asking their advice, and you suddenly then start to have a wish list of what's in it for them. And with anything that you are trying to change, I think the first thing you've got to do is, what's in it for other people as well as what's in it for me? And if you can get their what's in it for them, why do they come to work? What's their why? If you can get into that with your values and understand them, suddenly they'll help you. And then they will support you 100% through the entire process of going private. But they are shareholders, effectively, in what you do.
And vital, I would have thought, in the communication process as well. So you reach a point where, encouraged by your wife, you're thinking, right, I'm going to speak to someone that's already done it. You then speak to Michelle at Practice Plan. Yeah. You then canvas opinion, you reach the decision, and from what you said earlier on about letters going out, the letter goes out to the patients and it's big news. What was the reaction and what happened and what did you do?
I was excited when the letters went out, and then found out just after the letters had gone out that another practice was setting up an NHS practice within spitting distance,
right,
within days, which was quite an interesting moment. They have now gone private, so all those patients that went there, the issue that some of the girls had were they didn't want to see the queues that had happened in Scarborough. They were quite worried about that. They were worried about the bad press, and they were worried about patients having a go at them. Now, we didn't get queues of people signing it. We didn't get people being resistant. But what we had, that NHS practice opening was fantastic because there was a vent. Anybody who really didn't like what we'd done voted with the feet and went to this other practice. So we helped them build a business, but it meant that the girls were then not dealing with all this stress, because that's what they were concerned about. What are patients going to say? And having the support from Practice Plan on the days that we then converted, that also helped them, because there was somebody else then to help explain how it worked, somebody who knew the system intimately. We didn't know the system intimately. And you need that backup and support, that somebody was there and prepared to sit and spend time explaining to these patients and hopefully signing them up to the various plans that we'd got. That took the pressure off the girls.
And what was the patient reaction then? Was it?
Oh, all sorts. It's a working class area. People are wedded to the NHS. They will always have that pay my dues, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. There was some animosity, but nowhere near as much as I thought. What I realised is the attitude towards the conversion was largely dependent on the communication that we had as dentists in the run-up to the conversion. I had spent a lot of time speaking to my patients beforehand, investing the time, even though it was NHS, saying what was going to happen. And a lot of them were already pre-warned that this letter was going to land. Some of them had already made the decision to go somewhere else. Some of them had said they were going to stay with us and went somewhere else. Some of the ones who you thought, well, they'll not come back, are sometimes the first ones to sign up. If you don't have that conversation, you don't get the conversion rate. And one of my associates did not have the conversion, have the conversation, so he didn't have the conversion rate. But there was always a plan B. You've got to have a plan B in this kind of situation. To effectively, my plan B was to downsize, and that if push came to shove and not enough people converted, I would have to downsize the practice from a manpower point of view. Not massively, but I would still have a practice, and I would then be able to build on that core. The patients largely took it very, very well. because the press at the time was there's problems in dentistry, you know, the queues in Scarborough and things like that. But I cannot stress enough, the reason that I think a lot of them came is because they got the values of the team and the practice, and they appreciated what we were trying to do and why we were trying to do it. And you can only do that by talking to your patients.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I also think that one of the things that a lot of well-established dentists underestimate is just how much they've been doing that over the years,
yeah.
Not just in the immediate run-up to a conversion. And in fact, patients have bought into them over so many years. They may not be totally comfortable or trust other people's dentists,
no.
But their own dentist they feel comfortable with. And it's only when you put it to the test you realise just how many people value you, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like a personality cult. And they, you know, it's possibly one of the disadvantages of private dentistry, because when you come to then try to sell it, the patients have bought you. You're giving them part of you, and they get that. But it's a sort of a subliminal kind of communication. I've often said I don't go to work to see patients. I go to work and end up meeting a load of people who I've known for years, see a lot of them as friends and acquaintances, and do a bit of dentistry on them. And I think, you know, they are still patients. We still have that ultra-professional relationship. But there is nothing wrong with having that genuine interest in another human being that makes them feel more relaxed. They trust you. From the point of view medico-legally, if you have a true rapport with patients, they are less likely to, you know, want to see and have their day in court. You can drop the ball. You can't drop it very often, but it's a better environment, because they, when you say sorry to them, you genuinely mean it. When you say we need to sort something out, they genuinely understand it. When you say we've been maintaining this for a long, long, long time, are you still happy that that's the way you want to go? They understand the implications, because you're just having a normal conversation with someone, like we're having here now, with no ulterior motive. That's what it should be about on a communication level. And you're dead right. Dentists who've been established for a long time have got that rapport. And that's one of the key reasons why then they will continue to see you. The other thing that surprised me is how many people in the area who you wouldn't expect to be able to afford private dentistry suddenly will, and they do, and they might whinge a little bit about it, but I had my eyes well and truly opened and humbled in certain cases, because there are people who you make a judgment. We should never judge anybody, but you make a little bit of a judgment because you're doing your business model. You're thinking, if I lose 60% of my patients because they're of this demographic or whatever, I've got to do the sums. What's my projection? But I had patients who were on benefits. I've got pensioners who I knew struggled, and they joined, and that's humbling, and it makes you aware of your responsibility to them then as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose when they've prioritised you,
yes,
higher.
Oh, there's nothing
other
like,
things. That's,
yeah,
yeah. So in terms of that, you've made the decision, you've got the team on board, you've then communicated to the patients, you've got enough patients on board to have a viable private practice. How have you evolved the practice since you've achieved a form of stability?
Oh, it's evolution, not revolution. The first thing is realizing that you're playing a different game. You're not offering more expensive NHS dentistry. You've got to start looking at the offering, and you know, you can't just go down the line of doing the same as you've always done and expecting them to pay more. That will work for a while, but you are in a different environment now. Patients suddenly think you're more qualified when you're private. I don't know why. I had patients asking me for things that I was perfectly capable of doing, but they assumed that I wasn't able to do them before I was private.
That's interesting.
Yeah, you've got to look at everything as to how you maintain the standards and the qualities in the practice. You've got to, in a very ethical way, you've got to communicate with your patients what you offer and how you offer it. You have to market completely different. Your brand is no longer the NHS. Open the doors and they will come, because that's already been marketed for you. So you learn a whole new set of skill sets about, you understand marketing is not just sticking an advert in the local paper. Marketing is everything you do and how you do it. I now employ one of my staff who does marketing, and she is actually employed for her skill in marketing, not the fact that she's a dental nurse as well. I would never have dreamt of somebody having that kind of skill before. You have to then look at the offerings that you put in the practice. This could give you the potential to start doing a bit of dentistry that you've always wanted to do. It may give you the time to do it. It'll certainly give you the time to talk to your patients about these things, and the investment that you then need to make. Dentistry is an expensive hobby, if you like, but when you're starting to look at how the financial models support sticking a CT scanner in, how they would support sticking in intraoral scanners, you have to look at your business modelling in a completely different manner. But that's a good thing, because it's no longer a lick a finger and stick it up in the air and see what direction the wind's blowing. You're actually starting to plan things. And you can plan, because you're not on a 3-year timed contract, or you've not got the primary care trust, as it was then, coming in and saying, you've made this infraction, so we're going to give you a breach notice, and we don't care that you can't recruit an associate, you're still having a breach notice. You actually start to look at things in a much more open manner, and you start to draw on the experience of people such as yourselves and all the people that you know. It's like what Stephen Covey, I think it was, says, all the money that you ever need is in the pockets of the people you already know and the people they know. Well, turn that round. All the information that you need, all the business intelligence you need, is in those people that you already now know and the people they know, because you've suddenly opened this massive, you've taken the blinkers off, and you've opened this massive field of what I now say is proper dentistry. I'm not saying NHS isn't proper dentistry, so anybody out there getting offended by me saying that, it's not, but it's different. And you suddenly, whoa, there's like this big vista opens in front of you. And sometimes you need a map through it. And you ask the people who've been through it before and the people they know, and they're good guides.
Well, it sounds like you've sort of, I'm going to take this conversation full circle. We were talking about some of the prompts for you thinking about going private were to do with a loss of control.
Yeah.
And it sounds from listening to you that, albeit you get advice and input from various sources, you achieved the objective of staying in control. And if anything,
absolutely,
it's kind of opened up all sorts of possibilities.
Well, that's it. That scary moment when you're standing on the precipice, where I think at the moment you send the letters out, that is the point where you have both gained control and completely lost control, because you've just stepped off into what your brain is telling you is an abyss. But you've actually stepped off into, it's like going through the cupboard thing in Narnia, I suppose. You've stepped into a different world, and you are in control of whatever direction you take. Now, it can be difficult doing that within the remit of the way dentistry is governed and provided. That's different. But to actually then turn around and you can put something in place tomorrow, you can get that information today and pay for it properly. It's empowering to finally do that. And I think if a lot of people are honest with themselves, if they listen to this, fine, they can shoot me down, they can shoot me down, they can ring me at the practice and shoot me down. But I think fundamentally, the empowerment that you get from taking full control of your business and not having a third party dictate what, when, why and how, other than the ones that have a statutory right to do it, like the GDC, is a massive, massive, massive thing.
Well, I think that's an excellent note to bring this discussion to a close. I really appreciate your time and your thoughts, Simon. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you for asking me.